And it has tremendous potential. The time to start learning about AI is now, and the place is right here at the AI Bootstrap, sponsored by Outplaced, the AI-driven HR software for the 22nd century organization. I trust these next few days will be filled with sessions that will prompt you to think about using AI for your work as well as for yourself. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Well, what do you think?
I think we have some catching up to do.
No doubt. I also took a bunch of notes with ideas to take back to Consolidated International from the presentation. I wonder if anybody's working on any of this. I haven't heard anything.
Well, might be top secret.
Possibly. What about you?
I mean, I don't have a company to take ideas back to since I got ejected from Omnibox, but I particularly like the part where he was talking about the.
Oh, hang on. Text message from the boss. Please check your email.
Wow, I'm sure glad that my boss didn't text me whenever he sent me an email. My phone would never stop buzzing.
Me neither. He's never done that before. Let's see here. This must be what he's talking about. Roman Krantz. This letter is confirmation that your role has been selected for elimination.
I'm so sorry. Nothing like that personal touch. Text message and an email. At least my Dear Gilbert Stern letter was a Zoom call.
To receive your severance benefits, you must sign and return the separation agreement within 21 days and participate in an on-site knowledge transfer exercise tomorrow?
Wait, tomorrow? Really? Do they know that you're here?
Apparently so, and they want me to train my replacement.
It sounds familiar. Just tie decades of experience up into a neat package and hand it off to an intern with a ChatGPT login. Now, I noticed that use for AI wasn't mentioned in the keynote.
No. Looks like there's nothing left for me here. Might as well head for the airport.
Right now?
Well, what else is there to do? You saw the letter. It's like I'm a dead man walking.
That seem a little dramatic?
Maybe.
Well, look, you're here now. Stay through the rest of the day. I'm sure there's at least one flight that leaves tonight. Go to a couple of sessions and walk around the expo hall. Consider it preparation for your next adventure on the old company's dime. You never know what'll happen.
I suppose I could do that.
I'm signed up for the Getting Started workshop.
Me too.
Well, then let's get started.
This is John Ladley
and Mark Cooper.
Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Looks like Rosencrantz and Goldie Stern are both in the same boat now, so to speak. Not sure how they're going to survive.
History suggests they won't, but with AI, anything is possible.
So they say.
So they say.
We have a special repeat guest at Rock Bottom today.
Yes, Doug Laney, author of Infonomics and Data Juice, is back to talk more about treating data as an asset.
You know, most companies have tried introducing data governance through the CIO or CDO, and most have met with moderate success.
Your chances are better if you can reach the CEO, but that happens even less frequently.
Maybe we could try a flanking maneuver on the C-suite by getting the CFO, finance and accounting, on our side.
It's worth a try, but it's a lot harder than you think. It's entirely likely that nearly all companies are violating generally accepted accounting principles when it comes to data. That's something I'm working on, and we'll talk more about that with Doug.
Looking forward to it. Mind if I take the monologue?
Go right ahead.
When it comes to data, there are two types of companies: those that are aware of their data quality issues and those that aren't looking. Does your CEO know how bad your data quality is? Hopefully not, because that means you haven't had a negative event large enough or impactful enough to warrant attention at that level. At least not yet. AI is exposing data quality issues, and as a result, data is starting to get more executive attention, but don't mistake executive attention for executive interest. Their interest is in the business drivers. It's in the increased revenue or customer satisfaction. It's in the claim that the company is successfully deploying AI and, to a lesser degree, analytics. Although, if analytics was really a data quality driver, we would have seen greater engagement decades ago. In their most recent annual reports, or 10K filings, every one of the Fortune 50 companies acknowledged the role of AI in their operations. Every one of those Fortune 50 companies also highlight their use of data analytics or data-driven decision-making. I once heard an executive say that talking about data was like looking into the sun. He could only do it for a very short time before it started to hurt. Now, this is a very real but unnecessary mental block. Executives deal with data all the time. I've seen many executives at many companies poring over pages filled with columns of numbers. They're just called financial statements or sales reports or workforce plans, but it's just data. And they assume that it's correct and that there are processes in place to ensure correctness. And for a couple of domains, maybe that's true, like finance. You know, the production, management, and reporting of financial data is governed by generally accepted accounting principles and other regulatory requirements. Infrastructure, processes, and personnel are deployed in every department to accumulate and balance and report financial data. It sounds like an awful lot of information management, data governance, and yes, data quality applied to that specific domain. Now that's one. What about all the rest? Is it any less important to get that data right? Executives need to be educated about the direct connection between data and business drivers and the risks of unmanaged data, but not with 50-slide PowerPoint presentations and a Dimbuck wheel poster, heavens no. Instead, they need to know the questions to ask their subordinates, and they need to know how to evaluate the answers and how to follow up if necessary. Throughout this third series of the Rock Bottom Data Feed, we're going to talk about how data and data quality can be added to the CEO's plate. Oh, and one more thing, be nice to each other.
Rock Bottom Data Feed is proud to be supported in part by Dataversity. The Dataversity mission is to provide the single best source of education for anyone working with data, which is everyone. I'm pleased to have a return guest and a terrific guest. Welcome back to the Rock Bottom Data Feed, Mr. Doug Laney, live to us from Portugal. Hello in Portuguese, Boa tarde. He said. Boa tarde, okay.
Boa tarde.
We're talking about bad data and CEOs and executives and AI. We kind of have an arc going here in this, because all of those kind of all bubble up together. So the first thing is to just set the stage for the listeners. When we talk about is data bad enough for a CEO to care? What is that tipping point from, and you do, you're doing a lot of cool work right now. I got to share with the listeners. He is doing cool work. What does bad enough look like these days?
Wow. It reminds me of the phrase. I don't know if it's attributed to Winston Churchill or Machiavelli, never waste a crisis. And it was popularized by Rahm Emanuel, right? Obama's chief of staff and the mayor of Chicago, where I'm from. It's like they put up stop signs in town. They used to put up stop signs in my village whenever there was a car accident, right?
That's
so there
right.
would be no stop sign at an intersection until there was an accident. One accident, they'd put up a stop sign. So the tipping point is some kind of breach, right? Mm-hmm. Getting your name in the paper that way. Excessive cost for data infrastructure, data quality issues that materially impact revenue or customer experience might be another one. And clearly data governance issues that result in regulatory fines. So any of those kinds of issues definitely brings the topic of data to the boardroom.
That's as it should.
And I've heard it said that process really are corporate scars. So any place you see a process that's probably the result of something bad that's happened at some point in the past.
Yeah.
So as we're trying to get our executives to buy into data quality, data governance, paying attention to our data, the traditional arguments about data governance and data quality fall flat. I think we've all experienced that. What have you found that actually works?
You talk about processes, Mark, and I think you know, one of the main things is that it's not baked into business processes, which we often talk about data governance as this entirely independent, you know, animal, ugly animal nobody wants to be part of. And, you know, John wants to write books about, but nobody wants to actually, you know, do as part of the
story of my life.
This business process. So, you know, unless we really bake it into the business processes, then people aren't going to do it. I also think, you know, and we'll, this is a recurring, I keep screaming from rooftops on this one, the data's value isn't measured. You know, if we started measuring it as an actual asset, created even just supplemental balance sheets for the value of data, then it would get noticed by the boardroom before there is a snafu. I think data quality is, you know, we talk about data quality all day long. We build dashboards for data quality. We don't map it to expense savings or risk reduction or revenue generation. So in all my years, I've done this for maybe two clients. I've said, hey, can you help us map our data quality metrics to, or a data governance process to our data quality metrics to top and bottom line indicators? And it's amazing that it's only come up twice in with all the clients that I've worked with over the years. And then I think another big problem is the CDO doesn't have a seat at the table. You know, most CDOs are, you know, kind of in name, you know, chief data officers are in name only, don't have the responsibility, don't have the weight that the CIO or CFO or other O's have.
So to follow up on what you had just said about the two instances where they were measuring and we're linking these activities to business value and business benefit, what were the specific arguments that convinced them to go ahead and do that? And then also the specific, you know, the results, what did they see? And did that act like a flywheel to get them to keep?
Yeah, still a work in progress for them. So to be determined, there's a lot of inputs to source for that kind of framework and that kind of model. And, you know, that's problematic in itself. The impetus behind it was in one case, compliance issues. Another one was just trying to justify the expense for overall data management.
Just to follow up on the CDO not having a seat at the table, then you know, and being in name only. How is it that they were created in those instances, and what were they expected to do? Did they actually have a mandate, or was this just something that, you know, we need to have a CDO, so here, you're it, go figure it out?
Data is an asset. We should have somebody who is responsible for it and who we can point fingers at when something goes wrong. Yeah. But then most CDOs that I've met have been responsible for defining their own role. So the role wasn't even really well defined before they got it, which is both a curse and a blessing, right? So they can define the role, but then they've got to get sign off on that and build consensus, and they spend a year or more going through that exercise before they even hit the ground running, playing offense or defense, or ideally balancing both.
You were mentioning a couple of you know, instances where this happened, and that the CDO doesn't have the seat at the table, and we talk about the struggles and only two instances of doing something. So, I mean, that points to what's plaguing the world of data right now. And it's the fact is that from a logical, rational standpoint, no one argues that we got to do better. Nobody really argues much of that, but then nothing ever happens. So that I've been working with some research lately on just what is the root cause of that. So let's just kind of spitball here a little bit. You've got this elephant in the room of data. You've got ways to prove through data quality measuring and your Infonomics measurements out of your book, Doug's book, Infonomics. That was a plug, by the way. You're welcome.
Thank you. I'd rather have you plug the book that I actually get revenue from.
So what's that one?
Infonomics is actually Gartner IP. I wrote it while I was at Gartner.
Oh, that's right. Well, then we'll just forget them. No, it's
so
the
we want to plug Data
book.
Juice.
Yeah, Data one, yeah. Juice has lots of good stories in it. But what is the root cause I have some ideas on that, which I'd share, but if you're, you know, you're being held strapped into a chair and someone's threatening you with a really bad bottle of corked wine and you just don't want to go there. So what is the root cause of all of this? What is the one thing we have just absolutely missed and done wrong in the last 30 years?
Well, first I would cook with that wine. Wine should not be wasted, but yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that, but that's me. So
root cause. I'm not sure it's a matter of education. Perhaps a smattering of data literacy would do most, executives a world of good. For me, the root cause is we've discussed here previously, I think, and again, I've been just shouting from the rooftops for a couple of decades, is that data is not a balance sheet asset, even though it meets the criteria of one. So, I think that's it. Shakespeare said, kill all the lawyers. We don't want to do that, and we don't want to kill all the accountants. But I think the accounting profession is really to blame for the root cause of the mess that we're in, the failure to recognize data as an asset, even though it clearly meets the criteria of one. An asset is defined as something that is owned and or controlled, exchangeable for cash, and generates probable future economic benefits, also is separable from other assets. Those are the criteria. That's the definition of an asset. And there's no question that data meets those criteria. It's just that the accounting profession is steeped in this 85, 90-year-old history of when the asset classes were defined coming out of the Great Depression by the SEC. Data was all physical then. It was Hollerith cards and ledgers and books and stuff like that. Yep. And nobody really thought about it as a separate asset because then it was physical. And it wasn't until like 15 years later where, GE computerized, Arthur Andersen computerized the payroll for a GE plant, right? And it wasn't like until then we really started collecting kind of transactional data in the way that we think about it today. So the accounting profession still really hasn't come around. Now, there are some cases where you actually can put the value of data on a balance sheet. If I buy your database, I can straight line depreciate it on my balance sheet. But that's really the only case. So I see that as really one of the root causes. If we solve that problem, a lot of things would fall into place. Of course, we'd have to restate a lot of financials.
But
China's done this. So China actually instituted a financial model where they're now allowing Chinese companies to put the value of their data on their balance sheet as of about 18 months ago or so. And, maybe they're doing this to inflate valuations of Chinese companies, but, I like to see it as something, as a positive example of really recognizing the economic, the global economic value of data.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you talk about the history there, was the asset ever the data, or was the asset the ledger book? Running that forward, right? The asset is the computer, is the application, is the printout, as opposed to the actual data itself.
Yeah, Paul Strassman wrote tons of books. And I couldn't bring them all. Portugal about trying to quantify the value of IT. IT, that's two separate things. I and T. And if he had actually separated them and tried to value technology instead of information technology, he might have got somewhere, but he really struggled with this for decades.
Yeah.
He never really thought about information separately. And I think that if he had done that, he really would have made some progress.
For our listeners, this is in just intellectual pushback, because I really like that, but I'm going to push back on this balance sheet stuff.
Okay.
Again, if I ask the 5-why question, about not on a balance sheet, why not on a balance sheet? Why? It comes back to they don't know it's important. Okay, so how do we get the people that make the calls, the people that sit across, Ernst & Young's my auditor and I'm the CEO and I'm across a table once a year and I say, you turkeys, I've got some real problems with this and why haven't you told me I need to start to put this stuff on a balance sheet? So I'm going to push on this. This is a philosophical discussion, but I'm pushing. Why not? What do we say to people?
You know who gets this? The investors get this. the investors know. Investors favor data savvy and data product kinds of companies.
Yeah, but
data product companies have a market to book value ratio that's nearly three times higher than the market average.
That's data the Tobin ratio.
The Tobin Q ratio. Those that have a data governance organization, a CDO, maybe a data science or AI organization, those are indicators that a company is more serious about managing and leveraging their data. Those kinds of companies have nearly a two times higher market to book value ratio. What better argument do you need than, you know, impressing your shareholders?
So how do we get them to listen then? How do we turn the receiver on?
And is that correlation or causation? And do they make that direct line connection between what you just listed and...
That's a really good point, right? Yeah, really good point, because it may be just something culturally about those organizations that led them to use data better, and that's what's favored by investors. But then if you look at M&A activities, I don't have any examples right in front of me, but the premium that organizations pay for companies, like when Microsoft acquired LinkedIn, right? They weren't paying for me. They were paying for my data. They weren't paying for the application. They were paying for the data and the future value of the data. Yeah, how do we bring that to the boardroom? You know, people are just very myopically focused on the next quarter.
Well, let me ask you a question on an angle I've been taking recently in some discussion with my peers, like mostly poor Mark here.
Go for it.
And it's from the accounting angle, but it's not from the balance sheet angle. It's from the expense angle, and it's from GAAP. Okay, generally accepted accounting principles, for listeners that don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. All right. We have a lot of people saying use AI, use analytics, whatever, monetize your data. Mm-hmm. Create a revenue stream with data or save money with data. Well, generally accepted accounting principle number 4, simplified, says basically you match revenue streams with the expenses to create those revenue streams. All right. Mm-hmm. How many organizations are monetizing data by taking the results of an analytics group, a data scientist, or some AI work and going, look at us, we made some money? And how many of them have a accounting system, a ledger account set up that say, here's the revenue from this data-driven effort, and here's the expenses associated with that? In other words, what's the cost of goods sold? This is old accounting 101. Mm-hmm.
And including data as one of those costs rather than just
exactly
IT,
because when I look at balance sheets and 10K filings on publicly traded companies, there's IT budget and there's this little note about how we made money on some monetization thing, or we sold our customer data, or the airline sold the frequent flyer things during COVID and things like that. But nowhere do I see the cost of goods sold. I see all the money. And here's my position. I'll cut this short. I think another driver besides the balance sheet to wake up the CEO and the board is the fact that you're violating generally accepted accounting principles by doing data stuff the way we're doing it. You are actually you should have a qualified annual report. Ernst & Young, whoever should say, you haven't followed accounting principles because we don't understand the anthropological role of data and the accounting profession hasn't figured that out. But for the time being, we have to understand that all of these companies' income statements do not reflect the cost of those revenue streams. And the margins they're reporting aren't really the margins that are there. So that's just something. And I kind of didn't tell you about this. I wanted to get your gut reaction from that.
I like that.
Okay. All right. I will stop bothering Mark with that. I'm writing an article on it. If you want to weigh in or give it a review, let me know. But that's going to be coming out here. Okay. Moving on.
Before moving on. So that would, because the question I had, I'm the one here without the accounting degree.
Doug doesn't have it either, but I've trained him.
Oh, okay, good.
No. So that I just teach at the top accounting school, but I don't have an accounting degree.
I play one he plays one on television.
Gotcha. So there. Gotcha. As we're going through this conversation, I was curious about what the liability would be of not listing assets.
That's the balance sheet discussion, what you had just said. Well, no, I'm on the income statement side. Okay. Doug's the master of the balance sheet. I mean, when Doug talks about an asset, when you talk about assets, Doug, you also have to talk about the offset, which are your liabilities. Yeah. And there's another part on the right side of the balance sheet, and that's your equity. And that's where your Tobin ratio, and that comes in there too. Yeah. But we don't talk, I talk about data debt. Mm-hmm. Because organizations have a lot of liability to the future, but I mean, I guess the point is, guys, from all of this is we're ignoring a material item that should be on financial statements. We've we're violating the gap of materiality.
Counter argument: you can't include internally generated items as assets. So the question is, when I collect data from a transaction with you via my point of sale system or whatever, is that internally generated or is that externally generated? The accounting profession hasn't sorted that out yet. So they just say, it's internally generated, so we can't include it as an asset, just an expense.
And you know, and well, because they have to be careful, because that would mean a ledger entry would also fall into that. And that does belie some accounting theory conversations. This is meaty stuff, isn't it?
Meaty stuff? Yeah. See, I'm, probably I'm, lost I was, all of your listeners by now.
See, I was. What if you're a truck? I was still back at if you're a trucking company and you didn't list your trucks as assets, what kind of trouble do you get into?
Yeah. Well, you get into big trouble because you're not, from a generally accepted accounting principle, you are generating revenue but not recognizing the assets that create that. If you're deducting the expense of putting the gas in the truck, but you haven't put the truck on your book, then you are applying expenses and you don't have anything. You know, there's so – and this is a way – so much – everyone in our profession should go to Accounting 101.
And now, if you're creating data products, you've got finished goods somehow to account for.
Yeah. Now, if it's internal, look over at Mark on this, because Mark is a data products expert. We're going to be getting into data products in future episodes here, but Mark is really good at that. But there's the data products that are outward facing, and then the data products that are inward facing. And to your point, they're going to have two different treatments. So yeah, this is I hope our listeners are enjoying this, because I am.
There was a hell of a good time. Senate subcommittee hearing on how to evolve a 1930s style accounting system into the 21st century. Accounting firms got up and testified that the greatest source of value in the economy today is something that we can't quantify, and it's creating undue market volatility and all sorts of bad behavior.
But I have no strong feelings about that whatsoever. No. Okay, let's see, where are we here? We can ask some more questions, right, Mark?
So when we look at the Infonomics KPIs, what would be a couple of good ones to add to that executive dashboard?
So in the Infonomics book, we have these foundational measures of data's value, like its aggregate quality characteristics and scarcity, its business relevancy, and its impact on non-financial KPIs. Then all I've done is borrow from the way that valuation experts value any kind of asset, using the cost approach, the market approach, and the income approach. And those are the six foundational models. But what I'd love to see on a dashboard would be something that kind of combines some of them, like the net asset value of key data assets and how they're trending over time. How are those data assets being reduced in cost or increased in the value, the allocated value that they're generating? I think that would be great to see. And then I'd love to see something probably on the defense side, more of the like the regulatory risk score from improvements or degradation in data governance and data quality. I think those would be and something that, you know, I hate hindsight-oriented indicators, so probably something that was more foresight-oriented, like what do we expect to see out of our the value of our data assets given our current posture and position and projects.
But you still need to look backwards in order to have some foundation for looking forward, some way to do that estimate. So what would be some of the components of the cost side of it and components of the benefit side?
So the cost is to collect, store, secure, manage, govern, even access, define data, all that metadata stuff, right? Plus the governance. There's a kind of a standard when I create these models for organizations. I've got about 10 or 12 different kind of cost side things that we look at. And then you've got to get clever with how you're going to allocate those costs. Because if you've got a big cloud environment, all right, how much of that environment expense is going toward, is allocated toward any given data asset? So there's a bit of an art to a science. But listen, I'm more interested in how value is trending over time than what the discrete dollar or euro number is for any client. And it's like, is it improving? Is it degrading over time? At what rate? What are we doing to make that happen? That's much more interesting than coming up with a number for a balance sheet.
And then on the benefit side?
Yeah. I mean, so then on the benefit side is it's allocating, as John was talking about, data is one of those resources that goes into any value generating activity. So there are a number of things that go into that. Labor, land, labor, capital is the four factors of production, right? Land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. So you can break those down further. Data is the fifth one, I think, and we'll make the argument that the data ought to be a fifth factor of production.
Absolutely. So I've had challenges in the past doing that, where we'll put together, looking at business value, trying to tease out what the benefit, what ROI has been. A lot of times we get told, I'm sorry, that ROI has already been claimed by revenue.
Yeah.
And I always visualize this Oklahoma land rush with people there with flags, and they plant their flag in the middle of the meadow and say, "I claim this ROI in the name of revenue."
Yeah.
And then you're SOL.
Then you become a mad scientist and you go, "Wah, now what we're going to do is we're going to say, for this given process, we're going to give you no data. And now see how it runs, right?" And then
exactly. Then
make that case that you can't allocate it.
What's the ROI of tires?
Process, like, right. How are you, if you've got a sales process and you give your salespeople access to competitor pricing data, and some of them you don't give access to competitor pricing data, how differently do they perform in terms of sales cycle time, revenue generated?
Do companies actually do those types of experiments?
Well, online, folks like, Amazon and Walmart, et cetera, they run these experiments continuously, but it's not something that's baked into the culture of most companies.
Okay. A lot of the, another thing that I bring to bear in mm-hmm. this situation for you guys, because we, three of us haven't had a chance to talk about this. The cost, what I use is, and I did this with mm-hmm. the last company I really went deep in, which was a logistics company, is you have a supply chain. You buy your trucks, you buy your rail cars, you buy containers, you have people, mm-hmm. y'all. But you go to the cost account and they say that cabinet in the middle of the room on the loading dock costs $42. And that's part of the cost. And all those little minutia goes in there, and they have the cost and then the margins down to just to the 100th of a penny. Mm-hmm. Where's the data supply chain? And that goes to what you mm-hmm. were saying, to all the elements you were talking about, Doug, is the data supply mm-hmm. chain. And when I mentioned that to this logistics company, they went, "Holy smokes," because that truck driver has to fill out a form. And then someone has to enter the form, and we have a big project now to not fill out the form anymore. Are you capitalizing that project or are you expensing that mm-hmm. project? Well, we don't know. I said, okay, that's a big difference in what your final margin is going to be in your data supply.
Yeah.
So, and forcing them to think like accountants on something they haven't thought about mm-hmm. before makes a huge, huge difference.
And even before you do the valuation, do you even know what data you have? So a lot of organizations don't even have an inventory of their data assets. There's a story from in the Infonomics book where I was advising a energy client, utility client on their data strategy. And their data strategy document said, "We want to treat data as an asset, blah, blah, blah," the usual lip service. Mm-hmm. And then there was nothing in the document about even inventorying their data, creating a catalog or inventorying it. I said, "How are you going to treat data as an asset if you don't even know what you have?" And they're like, "Well, we inventory our trucks and our transformers and our generators." And I'm like, "Well, okay." So after the meeting, I go into the men's room and I see that they've inventory tagged their toilets and urinals and sinks, that everyone has a different number tag on it. Right. Yes. So they've tagged, that's important to them, I guess, to their physical plant, valuing or at least inventorying their toilets, but not their data.
Okay. Doug, last question, then you can get back to your Mediterranean sunshine. We need a call to action. First practical step for a newly convinced, we've educated a CEO to go, "Oh my data, I really got to do something about this." What should that CEO sponsor or get a handle on for the next 90 days? What should they do?
Well, we've talked about inventorying data, so let's start there. What data do you have?
Okay.
Let's inventory it. Let's use AI to inventory it. There are crawlers out there that will create it. Use various AI and scanning technology, and can do that pretty quickly. Then identify monetizable data assets, those that are underperforming or for which you can identify copious new ways to leverage or license them. And then I think third is establish a framework for measuring the quality, cost, economic benefits of key data assets. Kind of focus on the big rocks first, extrapolate from there, or evolve from there. I think that's what I do, and that's a good kind of combination of, I think, offense and defense that is required or expected of a data officer.
Cool. Doug Laney, thanks again so much. Awesome to
Thank
have
you.
you back. This has been a really quick hour. This has gone quick and we've solved many, many problems. I hope the
Yeah.
world is appreciative of this podcast. Doug Laney, the author of Infonomics, the author of his recent book, Data Juice. If you want to get some inspiring stories from that, please go grab a copy of that. Doug Laney, thank you so much for being on the
Great.
Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Mark, John. Cheers. Saud.
And thanks to our sponsor, Hubris Data Pros. Call us now because your data better be right when the auditors arrive. It's too late then for hubris. Hubris Data Pros.
Welcome to Dispatches from Rock Bottom, dredging up practical information, advice, and food for thought. We had a lot of talk today on our episode about leadership and chief data officers. So, what does a leader need to do? A quick survey of all the experts out there, besides the one we had on, reveals some common threads. And altogether, they make the CDO or the perfect CDO a kind of unusual person. They have to be strategic. They have to be a good leader and a good influencer. They have to know about governance and stewardship. They have to be technical. They have to do great communication and great storytelling. And that's probably the number one characteristic. They have to be an educator of leadership. They have to be sensitive to culture and sensitive to anthropology. They have to know how to execute and get things done. And at the same time, they have to be a visionary. That's a lot of stuff. If you're a CDO and you're handcuffed by a CIO or your organization chart, that's no good. You want to be a good CDO, listen to those characteristics, and then you have to learn to inspire people indirectly. Lastly, we've been doing a lot of look about the lack of experience, the lack of execution, the lack of talent in this industry. So there's a lot of new literature coming out on that. Please be sensitive to that. There's a lot of material coming out finally on new approaches. How do we do things? What it's all boiling down to this, folks, we're switching over to more soft issues from the project mindsets, and use your head, be creative. Sustainability is more important. Education is more important. Keeping people engaged is more important. Forget about the tools for a little while longer. Figure out exactly what it is you need. That's what I think. We'd love to hear your stories if you're willing to share. Write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
And we're back for our famous game show, the Audio Data Rorschach Test. Doug played during the first series, so we have a very special guest with us today. She's one of the Rock Bottom players, appearing in several sketches throughout our first three series, including the VOG announcer in our first episode of Rosie Krantz and Goldie Stern. She's also, not coincidentally, my wife, which makes her geographically convenient for playing the game show, as well as for delivering the prizes. So Karen, welcome to Rock Bottom.
Hello. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Yes, it is. And it's an honor to have you here. Now, you've had what you might call secondhand smoke exposure to our famous game show, but I'll explain it for those who might not have heard it before. In a minute, I'm going to ask you to pick a number between 1 and 4. I'll then play for you a piece of royalty-free public domain music. And since music is evocative, I'd like for you to tell us the first thing that you think of that's related to data. Now, I know you're not in the data business, but you are a professional singer and music teacher, and music is mostly math, and math is practically data, so you are in the data business. Makes sense?
I suppose.
Great. Then pick a number.
8.
8. That's a good number between 1 and 4. Okay, here we go.
Math.
All right. What does that make you think of related to data?
Loops.
So tell us more about loops.
Looping music. Synchronizing.
So all
the same thing over and over again.
So the data comes in and it keeps coming and over again.
On a loop.
On a loop. Karen, thank you very much for playing the game show. And
what's the prize?
Actually, you win all the prizes, every single one of the prizes. And when we figure out what they are, we'll send them to you.
Do you know my address?
I'll track you down somehow. And I'll be down to start making supper in just a couple minutes.
Great.
And thanks again to our sponsor, Hubris Data Pros, reminding you that any resemblance to actual events, persons, or businesses, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
Sounds like we need to reach out to a whole new constituency. Engaging accounting, finance, the CFO or controller will not only enable companies to start appropriately accounting for their data assets, it may also help generate the executive support for the proper information management activities we all know need to be done, especially to support AI. And be sure to visit dataversity.net and use discount code ROCK15 to get 15% off your first purchase. Until next time, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening, and remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom. You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, the fuss about data in the C-suite and on the balance sheet, at our website, rockbottomdatafeed.com. The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a Counter-Threaded production, copyright 2025, all rights reserved.